Today on Backroom Politics.
Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, much ado about bad pizza. GOP Tier 1 candidate Herman Cain continues to add fuel to the fire of the harassment settlement. When was the last time the future of the free world focused on Greece? Can you say Mount Olympus bailout? The Uber Super Committee is meeting in open forum today with both Simpson and Bowles on the docket. Will they touch the third rail of Social Security? Remember, it's the amps, not the volts, that get you. Seven, count them, seven Republican senators team with Democratic majority to vote yay on a $187 billion spending bill. Did we just see compromise, and is this the breaking point for the Tea Party? This plus Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. Radio. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former eight-term member of Congress representing Washington State's second district. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, thanks for joining us.
I am delighted.
To my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former senior staffer with the U.S. Senate. He is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He has served under four different presidents. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be back.
He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation and former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, thanks for being here.
Always glad to be here. It's a lot of fun.
And to my right, he is the Vice President of China Studies for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Glad to be here.
A lot going on here inside the Beltway. A lot of stuff to talk about, but we got to get to what's going on first. Let's get this out of the way, because we got to talk about it, because it is topical. Tier 1, his pizza's really bad, but he's got other problems now. Herman Cain now having a problem with getting the truth out about what really happened at the restaurant association that he was in charge of. Several years back. For those who don't know, he was apparently or allegedly accused of being inappropriate in some way to several female staffers at the association. And the word is still coming out on whether the settlement was breached, what the terms of the settlement, that's not being made public. But it is something that we need to talk about. And by the way, if you want to join the discussion, feel free to call in. Our call-in number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Bob, let me start with you on this. How big of a hit is this to the Herman Cain campaign? It seems that as quickly as he was on the rise, stuff like this keeps coming out about him, whether it's this crazy smoking ad or it's this restaurant association fiasco. What's going on?
Well, I'm not sure what's going on, but I am sure of one thing. It's very, very hard for a politician who is accused of sexual harassment or something of that nature to recover from it. And I don't know that he will be able to recover from it, particularly if there are two women who are prepared to say it's true no matter what he does, it doesn't work.
And one of the reasons that it's hard to recover from it is that the charges are so amorphous.
Absolutely right.
We don't know what sexual harassment is. And above all the possibilities, we don't know which ones might be at play here.
Yeah, I mean...
And how does a guy defend himself against a charge like that?
And supposedly coming from two anonymous sources, and the Kane campaign has said, how can we respond to this if we don't know who's making these charges?
Let's be clear about one thing. This is a story that broke originally over the weekend. It was a story that was first reported by our friends over at Politico, namely Mike Allen. Who's one of their senior reporters over there at Politico. It has been confirmed, apparently, through various sources inside the association and those close to the situation. But what strikes me, Alan, is that Politico gave Herman Cain 10 days to respond to or at least come up with their version of the situation, and they blew it off. Does that strike you as odd?
That doesn't strike me as odd. That strikes me as gross incompetence. When you have that kind of notice, what you do is you say, uh-oh, let's get our ducks in a row. Let's get a statement together. Let's come out and say, we were waiting for this. Here's what happened. Apparently, what the campaign did, and this went to the top, according to reports, Mr. Cain said, well, we'll worry about that when we get to it, when it comes out publicly. As a result, they missed the chance to get everything out. They started out saying, we don't know anything about this, and they were denying it, and his spokesman said, it's completely untrue. The candidate's early statements bordered a total denial. And then for the next 24 hours, he began to scale back and say, well, yeah, there was this charge. The only thing I remember about it was such and such, and initially not remembering that there was any payments, suddenly remembered, well, there was a payment. This is the kind of thing, this dribble out, that does incredible damage. Before we're done here, the other mistake they make is send everybody to the National Restaurant Association, where the answer is, we don't talk about these things. Believe me, this will all come out, and when it comes out slowly, it drags it out. It is incompetence. It's naive to think you can get away with it, and gross incompetence, and speaks very poorly about
this. I've got to tell you something. It strikes me as odd. Even the candidate himself, Herman Cain, he spoke at the American Enterprise Institute yesterday morning and gave one story, went to the National Press Club and gave another completely different story. In between at other press events here inside the district, Herman Cain went out and was changing his story almost haphazardly. Al, this has got to be, I mean, this is obviously a very amateur mistake in a campaign. Does this prove that Herman Cain may not be sustainable as a Tier 1 candidate?
Well, it certainly would indicate that would be a strong indication of that. And with Alan charging him with incompetence, I think that is accurate, but I think it is a brutal accusation if people start believing it, because there are a lot of things you can say about politicians, but nobody wants an incompetent one.
Right, but I mean, let's also look at the fact, and remind yourself, I mean, this is not the first time that a major harassment-type situation has been brought up in politics or even in confirmation. We saw that with one of the Supreme Court justices.
The thing I was going to say is that if, in fact, he doesn't have anything to say, then he may have played it fairly well.
But it did not. It did not. I mean, the Anita Hill situation did not kill the possibility of Justice Thomas being confirmed by the Senate to become a Supreme Court justice.
That's true, but he wasn't running for he wasn't running for public acclamation. He had the Senate, and as long as the majority was with him, he was all right. This is a different story, and I think we have heard for several months now that Cain is an amazing phenomenon because he does not have a real campaign operation as such. He doesn't have a lot of ads out there. He doesn't have phone banks and people in the states. He's just kind of skating on his own and doing very successfully at it. but this shows you what happens when you don't have a team of experts who know how to deal with an issue, and he may not himself believe that it's a serious problem. But I got to tell you, you know, my guess is the next time, within a week from now, we'll see a poll that he has dropped at least 50% in the numbers he's been getting.
But Alan, we look at, you've been involved in several campaigns. What would have been the right answer here? I mean, how does somebody who's a tier one presidential candidate, this kind of gets, this becomes a hand grenade that's lobbed into his lap? What is the proper response? How do you defer this?
First, well, you don't defer it. If you know it's coming, you prepare.
Right.
You don't say, wait till it emerges, and then go scrambling around with ever-shifting stories. You get the, you decide what the facts are, and you better decide that all of the facts are going to be relevant, even though some of it seems to be locked in. It won't be eventually. You realize that, and you put it all out there, dirty and difficult as it may be. We don't know, but we will find out. And that is the mistake here, of sort of being caught as though you're not prepared and then shifting your story. That may be the worst sin, although who knows what the facts are. Maybe the facts are the worst of all.
Right. Ralph.
I was at the press club yesterday to listen to Herman Cain's speech. And what was interesting is many of the questions, instead of being related to his 999 plan, all focused on this issue with sexual harassment. And at the end of the day, talking with the people at the lunch, many of them felt that he really didn't address the question. It was like he was trying to hide something. And they felt that if he addressed it directly, they would have more respect for him as opposed to trying to dodge and hide from the issue. So it'll be very interesting to see how he deals with this moving forward.
Well, I mean, the dynamics here. I mean, Al, you obviously, as a seated member of Congress, ran at least 8 campaigns, you know, your initial election and then re-election. When you see the amateur mistakes that are being done, I mean, obviously you never would have put out my chief of staff smoking a cigarette on a political ad. I don't think you would have not taken a press request for information on a serious situation like a sexual harassment charge. Does it make sense for Herman Cain to take the current position that he is?
No, but one thing occurred to me. You know, for a candidate in a campaign, there is so much adulation out there. You're speaking before friendly audiences most frequently, very often partisan, or very often people that you drag into the room to applaud for you.
Right.
And you can get the impression that you're a heck of a lot more popular and a heck of a lot stronger in the competitive race than you actually are. And it's your staff back in the little dark room that is the ones that come to you at the end of the day and gives you the bad news, you know. And Herman Cain is acting like somebody who has been kind of overcome by the adulation, which he's had a lot, and much of which may well be true. And he's behaving now as though he thought he could float through any of this.
But, Bob, we look at the other candidates on the GOP ticket. We have not heard comment out of Mitt Romney that's been notable on this situation.
On anything.
Rick, well, okay, we'll get to that later. We'll get to that later. Easy.
Let's be civil.
We haven't heard anything coming out of the Rick Perry campaign, and Rick Perry has the most to gain from this by elevating himself back up to tier one status. Are they backing off for a reason?
Yeah. When if someone is committing suicide who's against you, don't stop him. Let him do it.
Well put, Bob.
And don't look like you're shoveling dirt on the grave. You know, look, stand back and say, oh, it's so sad. That's the smart thing to do.
But obviously, the bottom line on this is that we now have a tier one candidate who was, how did he get to this point, facing the real first hurdle in this campaign with him as a tier one candidate. Alan, is this really a sign of things to come with the campaign?
I would disagree that this is the first hurdle. I think 999, you've heard me say it before, was a major hurdle. Getting a lot of attention and a lot of focus, and I think that it was probably going to be lead to the demise of his candidacy, regardless of his I'm not Romney candidacy. And now this sort of comes in, swamps everything else, and he's handled it about as badly as you can. Let me just say one word about the different. You raised the Clarence Thomas issue, and I feel compelled because I know that issue painfully well. Clarence is a friend of mine, of long standing. In that particular case, there was no history. A woman came forward and made some charges in a matter of days, right in the middle of his confirmation process. They delayed the final vote so they could hear from her and hear from others. There was not a written history. There weren't other people who were involved. It was much more in the he said she said genre. In this particular case, he did things that the National Restaurant Association, or things were alleged, and settlements were reached with a couple of women who have still not been identified. I'm guessing we'll know who they are before we're done here. It's a very, very different matter in this particular case because of that written record and the role of other people. It's a lot harder for him to pretend that it didn't happen, but whatever it was.
But Al, you know, we look at the Bill Clinton, the candidate Bill Clinton, then governor of Arkansas, and, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the tales of his womanizing were floating almost weekly during the 1994 campaign while he was running for president,
and
he was an up-and-comer at that time as well.
But they'd been around for years, but people nationally don't hear about governors doing that, but he had that reputation long before he was a candidate. And how he survived it, I don't know. It has to do with there's magic to Bill Clinton, whether... If you think he's a good guy, it's magic. If you think he's a bad guy, it's the evil eye.
But Bob, it does bring up the question, though. I mean, obviously, this has something for the campaign staff with Bill Clinton in 94 versus the campaign organization, or lack thereof, that Herman Cain has now in 2008.
Well,
is that accurate?
Sure, but we said just a little few minutes ago that, you know, he has been it's been clear that he doesn't really have a campaign staff. Or a campaign. He's almost skating all by himself through this. He has very few people on his staff.
Sure.
He's not organized. He doesn't have any professionals who have experience in this area. It's one of the reasons, as Alan said, the first thing you do is you get all the facts and put it all together and get a good response. He hasn't done the normal things you would do if you had a good, strong campaign staff behind you.
And
he's got nothing behind him.
And you can believe that because the rumors had been around for a long, long time, that Bill Clinton's staff had plans to handle various things, and they couldn't keep them from coming out, but they handled them overall fairly well.
But Alan,
they did everything except put a padlock on his zipper.
Alan.
And Bill Clinton listened to the advice of his people. And there's some reason to believe that Cain is not a very good listener. Now, everyone has talked about this memo that supposedly went around, that apparently went around to people who were writing with him and said, do not speak to him unless spoken to.
Right.
I mean, if you consider the fact that he's only got a handful of people who are around him anyway, and if the rule is don't speak to him unless spoken to, how much advice is he even going to hear, much less listen to?
That's a good point. Ralph.
What if Herman Cain decides to apologize and say, look, hey, I made a mistake. Let's move forward and focus on the issue. How do you think people would react?
That's a good question. I mean, does he have the opportunity to do mea culpa right now, Al?
I don't think he built the heft to be able to do that now. Some candidates have got the heft, and that might work.
But
I agree.
Yeah,
we also need to know what the facts are. And we still
Correct.
Don't know exactly what happened, what there is to apologize for. He's saying there's nothing to apologize for. My guess is there's probably a little more to it than that.
Right.
But he's blown the chains. I mean, that's one of the things you do in that upfront statement. We've been waiting for this. Here's the history. I have already apologized. I'm doing so again, if an apology is appropriate. But we don't know the details. We don't know the facts. We'll find out.
And he runs the risk of letting it drag out and having something really bad come to the
Plus,
forefront
he
and
has,
not apologize.
He has the most difficult problem of all. He's got to prove a negative.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's hard to do.
But it's going to be a drip, drip, drip. Both women are going to be identified. People are going to be asking him what happened, what was the conditions that he agreed to in the consent decree, or the association agreed to, how much money was spent by the association to keep them quiet. It's all going to come out, and it's going to come out not in one lump, but it's going to come dripping out over the next 10 days or 2 weeks. By the time it stops dripping out, he won't have 10% of the audience.
Alan, this also begs the question, when we see somebody like Herman Cain and we see all the problems, his polling numbers really didn't take as much of a nosedive after that smoking ad came out. Is this more of a situation, it's Mitt Romney versus everybody but Mitt?
Yes. Yes, it's Romney versus the non-Romneys. He has a good, solid base in the 20 to 25% range just about everywhere. He hasn't gone down much. He hasn't gone up much. Other people rise and fall. And it looks a lot like it's now Kane's turn to fall.
Right. Around the table before we close out this segment, can Herman Cain survive this? Al?
I don't think he could survive before this, and this isn't going to help.
Alan?
I associate myself with Al's remark. I never thought he would make it, and this just makes it, even if the facts are not bad in his case, the incompetent way they handled it has to hurt him as well.
Right. Bob?
Nope, he's gone.
Ralph?
I don't think he can survive this. I think there's more to the story that's going to come out.
I think he's done in 60 days. I don't see him, unless he starts spending his own money, I have a feeling that the money's going to probably dry up real quick. That star is out.
Why do you give him 60 days?
I give him 60 days because, let's be honest. Herman Cain is not somebody without means. He's done very well by serving really bad pizza to people in the Midwest. He could self-fund himself for a little bit. I don't think he goes out above 60 days.
Well, I think it'll be closer to 6 days than 60.
I think I would have given him 16.
Wow. Well, all right. Hey, look, everybody's opinion's equal on this show. When we come back, we're going to talk about the latest coming out of the Super Uber Duper Committee on the Hill. They're having an open session even as we speak right now. They've got every budget person that's ever come up with an idea on how to come up with austerity measures on the docket. We're going to talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. we're back live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. You're welcome to join the conversation. You can call in and ask questions, give your comments at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We're going to change gears here for a second and talk about what's on everybody's mind here in D.C. is the Super Committee is now actually holding an open forum session on the Hill. And it's gotten the attention of a lot of folks, namely because of the fact that we've got some of the fiscal spending retraction, austerity measure. Some of the authors of some of the plans that have been brought before Congress and the White House are now testifying in front of the Super Committee. Most notably are Mr. Simpson and Mr. Bowles, or Mr. Bowles or Mr. Simpson. It doesn't matter. You can call it either way. Alan, you were also saying there's also a couple of other planners
There were two big committees. One was the Bowles-Simpson, which got the most visibility, but there was a parallel effort with former Senator Pete Domenici, from the longtime chairman of the Budget Committee, and Alice Rivlin, former head of the Congressional Budget Office,
right,
and CBO True Expert. Rivlin actually sat on the Bowles-Simpson, and she co-chaired the Domenici-Rivlin.
Rivlin.
And these are experts. They're bipartisan people. Both of them were talking about $4 trillion over 10-year exercises that included a mix of spending changes, including the entitlements, and revenue increases. Those are the four people who came today to talk in open session to the Super Committee as they come towards crunch time.
Is this a case where now the Super Committee may be looking back at both Domenici Rivlin and Bowles Simpson and saying, wait a minute, we've got to take a real serious look at these plans? These are actually some good ideas to bring us back in.
I don't think they ever stopped looking at that stuff. They were on the table from the beginning. Now they're coming back onto the table for consideration as these groups try to figure out where to go from here. There have been some offers back and forth, and now they're reminding themselves what a bipartisan group in both cases came forward with, and maybe they deserve another one.
One of the stories that's been talked about here inside the Beltway has been the situation regarding the Super Committee itself and how successful it will be. Apparently, there are several budget experts around town that have said that the Super Committee could ostensibly fail the country as a whole. Bob, why is that? Why are they coming out and saying that this could be a total failure and that it's dead on arrival to begin with?
Well, a failure would mean they can't reach an agreement on anything. That's possible. It is certainly true if you take a look at the two proposals that were laid out the last week. They look pretty much like the traditional party positions which have been there for the last year. There's been very little change. And I suspect that those were fundamentally just, in my own mind, those are just opening gambits that both parties laid down. I don't think anybody believes that there's not going to be some movement in some way. The question is, can they get to an agreement? And I don't know that they can.
But Congressman Al, you've been in Congress. We've got some very dynamic personalities sitting on the Super Committee. Are these people that, in fact, can affect change and show compromise at the same time?
Well, it's a mixed bag in that regard. What I would like to know is who are the people that are sitting in the chairs behind them? Have we got policy people from the two parties back there, or have we got the political people from the two parties back there? If it's the political people, there is not a chance in hell of them ever reaching agreement.
Well,
if they've got policy people back there, then maybe.
Alan, what do you think?
I think that these guys are taking this job very seriously. They're pretty smart people. They tend to be leaders in different kinds of ways. They represent different interests. They're not ignorant of politics, but I think they're taking their job as one of 12 very, very seriously. They're listening to staff. They're listening to experts. They're listening to politicians. They're doing what politicians do. They weigh everything. And also, by and large, and I think Al would acknowledge this in a weak moment, that most of these guys really do want to do what's best for the country.
But Bob, as we look at this going forward, I mean, it going back to Congressman Al's point, it does make sense to kind of put the politicos back in the box and listen to solid, you know, the solid budget people. Listen to the CBO. Listen to what OMB is coming up with. Listen to the recommendations of Simpson Bowles. As a politician, and you've been involved with Congress a long time, can they do this unpolitically?
Well, of course they can, and they have been doing it. I mean, they've listened to experts all one side and down the other. The chief of staff, who is for the super committee, whose name I have forgotten, is a senior Senate staffer who has worked for the
Finance Committee
forever and has the highest respect you can have on both sides of the aisle as an absolute straight down the middle professional rather than a partisan. So you've got excellent good leadership of the staff. And I am sure that they're getting the best information and advice they can possibly get. And I also agree with what we've been saying that, you know, there's going to be a lot of effort to find a solution. The problem is going to be that it isn't just a super committee membership, but look at the pressures they're getting. Recently, a group of the liberals in the House went over there and testified and sent letters. And some of the Tea Party people have been over there and testifying and sending letters. You know, there are political pressures internally that are coming to them within the system, within the structure of Congress. There are organizations outside, from business organizations to labor organizations to ideologically oriented interest groups. They're all been up there talking to them, either publicly or privately, and I'm sure they have heard so much they're ready to scream. The fact of the matter is, they got to close the door and sit down. They got to find if they can cut a deal, and let's hope they can.
Right. Well, I think at the end of the day, American people are going to judge them on whether they're able to close the deal.
Well, I mean, there are small glimmers of hope. I mean, it was reported this morning that six members of the panel, namely Camp, Portman, Upton, Baucus, Kerry, and Van Hollen, have met separately from the committee itself and tried to reach a deal in the area of about $1.5 trillion. If that's the case, does this give you a little bit of a glimmer of hope that we could be close to a deal?
What troubles me is that whatever these guys come up with and that they bring back to the larger bodies, the House and the Senate, that's when the politicals come in and say, they whisper in your ear and say, do you really want to be reelected? You really want to put to the Democrats, you really want to take on the AARP? You really want to do that?
Well, they're doing that today. Social Security, apparently, is on the table.
But listen to what I'm saying. When it gets down to where you get it out of these people that are, and I agree with people say that they're serious about this and they're doing their homework and they're studying the facts and they have lots of information, but they only have one vote when it comes to the whole body voting, and it's these others all around who will be less well-informed, and they're the ones that are going to be listening to the little Iagos on their shoulder saying, you really want to be reelected? You're going to really? And it's the message is different whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, but each have the little devils that
each party, as Al says, have interest groups that help fund them, help support them back home, help them in all ways they can to get reelected. And those people, a lot of them, are going to have interests that will have to take a bit of a haircut in this. If we're going to get to a solution that is workable, and there are going to be people who say, "Hey, don't cut me," and we'll remember if you cut me, we'll remember it.
Well, I'm shocked by the AARP. I'm the Democrat. Remember,
I know. And by the way, a card-carrying member of AARP.
No, I resigned from the AARP when they supported George Bush on that other thing.
Really?
on the prescription drug and didn't pay for it.
Right, exactly.
I'm shocked by this out there.
Well, you shouldn't be.
He's an honorary member, though.
eligible to come back.
What I'm saying is, I am shocked by the tone of that message, which is just a threat. It's a heavy-handed, bare-knuckle threat. And if they're starting this soon, that kind of stuff, it suggests that this is going to turn very, very nasty, because there are other people that can threaten as well. Organized labor hasn't even said much yet.
Alan.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's no free lunch here. There's no easy place to go. And that's what AARP's role, or the Tea Party, or anybody else is reminding folks. There's no easy source of dough here. So everything has been, continues to be on the table. Social Security, taxes, everything is still on until there's a deal or not a deal. So we ought not to be surprised at that. I think that the real measure of success is going to be if they get an agreement and have a pretty solid majority, maybe 8 out of the 12 who support it, enough to pass it in the Congress. And if the market responds well, then I think everybody wins some. And if the market responds poorly, then they all blame everybody else. So I think that we can deal with changes to Social Security and Medicare and, yes, revenues. If the market likes it and people feel positive about it, and that will be the ultimate measure.
Well, two key factors that show that Social Security is, in fact, not only in play but being seriously discussed is Majority Leader Boehner yesterday gave a speech. Speaker Boehner. I apologize for that. House Speaker Boehner gave a speech yesterday in Kentucky where he basically said, quote, "Nothing would send a more reassuring message to the markets than taking bipartisan steps to fix the structural problems in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security." That sentiment was, I want to say supported by, but that sentiment was paralleled by Senator Patty Murray out of Washington, who said that everything is on the table, we've made no decisions, but she did continue to say that they're not going to talk about any of the details, but that everybody on the committee is serious about finding a way forward, which leads us to believe, one can make the assumption, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the non-discretionary spending is going to be seriously looked at.
Now, I would point out, one, Patty Murray did not exempt some of the Democratic things, and Boehner did not include any of the Republican things.
And Mitch McConnell was standing right next to Boehner when he made that statement.
But
he made it at where they both spoke, and you know, I think McConnell was an honored guest or
right.
something. And Boehner spoke, and McConnell was right there and was comfortable with what Boehner said, which I think is also important.
Well, go ahead, Al.
Maybe I misunderstood what Boehner said, or maybe you misunderstood what I said, Bob, but it seemed to me that what Boehner said was, we got to come together and we got to find things, and then he listed all of the Democratic gifts.
Well, but
he didn't mention any Republican gifts. Patty Murray at least didn't exempt any of the Democratic movements.
Alan,
I got to say, it strikes me as interesting when we talk about Republican gifts and Democratic gifts. No Republican is excited about making changes to Medicare, Social Security, or Medicaid. These things are painful. They're painful to voters. They're also highly resistant, as we know, to so-called tax increases. People are giving the Republicans no credit for putting $650 billion of new revenue into their offer. It's not tax changes per se, it's fees relating to Medicare and so on. There's a lot of money they're putting out there. So I think that yes, we tend to identify certain things with both parties. I think that that's a little simplistic and unfair to the challenges and the difficulty of the process.
But both Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles said in front of the committee today, we cannot tax our way out of this mess either. there's got to be give and take. And we keep talking about the gives. The question is, what are the Democratic takes and what are the Republican takes here? Al, what are the Democratic takes possibly?
Well, I think you've got to reform Social Security. I think there are all kinds of ways of doing that without impacting people who are currently on Social Security or about to be within the next decade. There are ways to do that, extending the age and so forth and so on. And that has to be done. I think the more difficult one is Medicare, because you can't get any short-term benefits if you don't do short-term cuts. So that's going to be harder.
Bob?
But you know, the point is, the way to, the Social Security problem is, the best way to solve it is there are about five or six different moving pieces. You can do a little bit of increasing the rate of tax on both the individual and the employer. You can raise the age a little bit over periods of years. You can put a little bit of a higher tax on the benefits of those wealth of people who are much wealthier than other people as far as benefit delivery goes. So there are a variety of things that can be done, and if you take each one of those things and use it just a little bit, as opposed to saying, oh, we're going to move the age from 65 to 75 tomorrow, something like that is not going to work. But if you move it up slowly and you play around with all these different pieces, there is no reason why even people who are looking at the benefits 20 years down can't say, well, that's not unreasonable. I can live with that.
Yeah. What about private accounts for younger workers, which was bandied about?
Well, I would think probably if you try to put that on top of a deal for Social Security, you probably have too big a load.
Mm-hmm. Alan, when we do talk about this third rail of non-discretionary spending, namely Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, we see the campaign that AARP has put out. That's got to be resonating with the members, particularly with the fact that, let's be real, senior citizens tend to vote a lot of the time in a lot of these elections. Are they starting to get worried that they may be touching something they can't recover from?
Well, remember, we're talking about a group of people who today enjoys approval nationwide of 9%. So how much more can they hurt themselves? I mean, I think these guys, these folks, men and women, really care about the future. Yes, they'd like to be reelected, but they're very unpopular as a group and as individuals. And so one could argue, I suppose, that there's no better time to do something else unpopular than now when you're already unpopular. And goodness knows, maybe some good big things will come out of it that might lift all political boats.
I mean, Bob,
this might be a chance, as Alan says, for everybody to join hands and jump off the cliff together, because they can't hit it any harder when they hit the bottom, when they're only at 9% now.
Dream on.
Wow, taking a page from the Herman Cain campaign, you just break out the song.
Sing to us.
Wow, sing out. That's awesome.
He sings better than I do.
Yeah, but apparently can't campaign his way out of a paper bag. When we look at everything coming down the pike, I mean, there's obviously other takes that have to be there. The one take that nobody's talked about is defense spending or defense cuts. Secretary Panetta has done a good job as far as proposing some serious funding cuts to DOD on his own. Has he taken the load off the super committee as far as defense spending goes, Bob?
I don't think so, in this sense, that you notice that the only people who are saying anything nice about what Panetta is saying are a few Republicans, and not even the Republicans on the Armed Services Committee are certainly not saying very anything. And none of the Democrats are. The Democrats, are not talking nice about where Panetta's going. They're not happy with that either. I don't know where it's going to end up, but fundamentally, Panetta has made it possible for people to look beyond what Gates has done. And I think that's the most interesting thing, because, you know, the one thing about Panetta is that we inside Washington have recognized how much respect and respect for the man himself, the jobs he's held, the respect he has among his former colleagues in the Congress is very high. And I think there's a lot of respect for what Panetta said, just like there was a lot of respect for what Gate was talking about. So I think he has a little bit of credibility, but he's not getting a lot of support on Capitol Hill from him.
But Congressman Allen, we've talked about the social program funding cuts or revamping of those programs. We haven't heard much coming out of the super committee, which surprisingly been very tight-lipped in a town where leaks happen every day. Does it strike you as odd as that we're hearing about the social programs and not seeing defense cuts being brought up to the forefront?
I think that Gates did the Defense Department a lot of good by coming in early and coming up with a credible package of cuts and saying, now you got to be very careful if you go beyond that. And we had a candidate running for Congress here on the program.
Dakota Wood,
who explained that, yes, while on the surface it was France and Germany and NATO and all that were taking care of the military things in Northern Africa, it was America that had the technology to allow them to do that. And that had America not had that military capability, they could not have done what they did. So that's sobered me.
Right.
A lot. Maybe what we don't have on this panel is a purebred, way out liberal, cut defense spending and the hell with it. Because I'm not there.
Right.
I think we can cut more, but I think you need to be very careful.
We've got on the table $450 billion of defense cuts over the next 10 years.
That was proposed by Secretary Panetta.
That was the Gates and then the Panetta,
right.
Panetta piece. That's a whopping amount of money that is not built on reducing the role of U.S. role in Iraq and Afghanistan. What you've got, therefore, is a core of folks saying we've cut it, on the Democratic side saying we've cut enough, and a bunch of Republicans saying we think you maybe have cut too far. So I don't see the majority available to do considerably more. There are people who think you should do more, like our buddy Al here, but I think that's a real minority view at this point, and I just don't see a lot further cuts on the defense side.
Ralph,
mind you, I said with great delicacy and care, I'm not for going in there with a machete and chopping up the defense budget.
Ralph,
you have China and Russia that are increasing their military expenditure, so it's going to be very interesting how the U.S. is going to be able to deal with the threats, cyber attacks, and so forth, coming from different countries if we have to cut back on military spending.
Bob.
Just to underline how tough this gets, I don't know exactly the right designation for. There's a joint fighter that is being developed.
F-22.
Joint strike fighter.
22.
Correct.
That for the Army, for the Navy, and for the Marine Corps, the Air Force.
Air Force, Marine Corps, Navy.
Correct. And everybody's going to have a model, but apparently, the one that the Marine Corps have is it can fly off of carriers short. It's not working.
Correct.
It's not working, and no matter what they do, they can't make it work, and there's talk about, you know, killing the plane, killing this particular model because it isn't working. And just recently, I have been listening to a flurry and seeing a flurry of advertisements on radio and television talking about how important this is for the Marine Corps. We can't let it go. This is a great new thing, and by God, we've got to push this forward. Obviously, what we have here are the military industrial complex, the developers of the plane, the builders of the plane, the union people who work for build the plane are all in this together, saying no matter what, we want to keep this thing alive when the Defense Department doesn't think it's a very good plane. Now, obviously, it'd be nice if somebody decided what to do with it, but that shows you how tough it is to kill something that obviously isn't working, but people still want to do whatever they can to keep it alive. And apparently the problems are very, very complex technical problems, which they cannot overcome.
Well, you know, it's funny. taking off my moderator hat and just making a comment, you know, we look at the way that our military has evolved over the past, say, 30 years, where we've gone from a Cold War, got to beat the bear to the bone against the Russians, to a more nimble, a more fractioned enemy in some of the Muslim extremists, some of the even some of the terrorist activities that are happening outside the Muslim community. We're putting more of a reliance on not having boots on the ground, but having technology such as unmanned aerial vehicles, such as remote sensors. That type of technology is going to help us make those cuts, which begs the question, do we need a joint strike fighter? Do we need manned aircraft, for that matter? These are very, very serious changes, but we've got two very smart people, one of them arguably the greatest Secretary of Defense we've had in Bill Gates, and somebody who knows this program better than anybody, and now Secretary Panetta,
yeah,
who have come back and said, look, we are a different military than we were in the days of the Cold War. We're going to have to change our spending habits the way it happens. That's just reality. Now, the question is, can they convince the Super Committee, can they convince Congress? That's just some of the heartache we're going to have to take. Al?
No, I agree with that. The problem is that Congress tries to give people who come to Congress committee assignments they want. And there are two kinds of people who want to get on armed services and the comparable committee in the Senate. Those who would give the military everything they ever possibly wanted, and those that would like to abolish the military altogether, and we can
and create a small national defense force.
Exactly. And you don't get on those committees the middle ground as much as would be really useful, people who can weigh these things without having a huge preconceived sense of what the should be.
Let's take a step back and look at the larger issue before the Super Committee. The question is going to be, what number, what is the bottom line number that of cuts that they can come up with that will make the Super Committee fail or be successful? Bob?
I believe the number in the law, the resolution that was passed, is $1.2 trillion. Am I right
on
that, guys?
$1.2 trillion is the basement in the law, but is $1.2 trillion going to be enough to make the Super Committee successful? Or are they just going to go, we just did what was mandated by the law?
Well, I don't think anybody thinks that $1.2 trillion over 10 years is enough. I mean, when the president and Mr. Boehner were looking at a big deal, they were talking pretty close to $4 trillion.
Right.
And the budget, the CBO has projected the fact that if you don't go at least $4 trillion in 10 years, the deficit, which is $14 billion today, will be, something like $18 or $19 trillion by the time we get to the end of the 10 years.
Yeah,
but if you get to where you can get the 1.3, grab it and stick it in a drawer and lock the drawer.
Yeah,
then come back and get.
We proved we could at least get a start on it, and that's important.
Alan?
I think the biggest failure would be not to get to 1.2. And anything, as you go above, the more you get above that, nobody's thinking of any number bigger than $4 trillion at this point. That's sort of the outer limit. 1.2, if they fail on the 1.2, that really is an a grotesque indictment, because that's what the law requires.
Yes.
I think that the closer you get to 4, the better the signal it sends. It's really hard to predict that's going to happen.
Ralph,
am I... My sources abroad have said that it has to be 1.2 to 1.4 to avoid any kind of negative reaction in the markets and a possible downgrade.
Do we actually foresee the committee possibly coming up with something above? I mean, we just heard in reports today they're talking 1.5, 1.7. Can we see a committee that might actually come up with something in the 2.5 to 3 range? Bob?
I think it's going to be hard enough to get between 1.2 and 1.3 or 4. I really do. It's going to be awfully hard. There's going to be a lot of give on both sides, and the Congress right now isn't structured to make that an easy decision.
Alan?
Absolutely they can. I don't know that they will, but they certainly can. I think the fact of the matter is, if they jump into a 1.2, 1.3 to 1.5 number, there's going to have to be spending cuts and some piece of revenue, whether it's fees or taxes or tax reform. Once you cross that Rubicon and throw and start touching some of the entitlement programs and put some revenue in there of some kind, then the leap is not as great conceptually to double it.
So basically 1.2, you're saying, could be just a glass ceiling. We'll break through that once we get to that point.
I think there's still a decent chance that they'll, especially after a day like today and watching the markets and watching what's going on in the world and how fragile our economy is and how much the public does not like or respect the Congress. I could see various sorts of scenarios that might lead to a considerable bigger number in the 2.5 to 3 trillion range.
Congressman Al, you've been on the inside. You've worked with some of these people. What do you think?
Well, having been on the inside of some legislation that was very complex and what have you, and realizing that my biggest problem was that most of my colleagues didn't know what I knew about that legislation, brings me to suggest this. We don't know what that committee is talking about. We don't know what their thinking is. We have very little information from the inside, which is probably a good thing,
right,
from the standpoint. But to call, to answer your question, you need a lot more information. I hope Alan is right, because what Alan says makes a great deal of sense. But whether that's what they're thinking, we don't know.
Bob.
To step back a minute and suggest something. The Ways and Means Committee and its chairman, Mr. Camp, who is a member of the Super Committee, Mr. Camp has been working for the better part of a year and a half on an overhaul of the tax code. They've made a lot of progress in identifying some things they can do that would improve the tax code substantially. It is possible. It isn't just that you need to get to, let's say, 1.2 as your minimum requirement, but the super committee is also authorized and has the authority to tell the Finance Committee of the Senate and the Ways and Means Committee to get with it and produce within a certain amount of time a major overhaul of the tax code. There are some things that can be done that will not, the day they vote on the super committee's report, you make some cuts, but what they can do is they can also move some other things that are bigger and broader. They have an authority to do it. Now, the which would also be a very positive thing.
But does it make sense, Alan, to include the tax code in the super committee right now, or they've got enough problems to deal with?
Well, we don't. If they come up with new revenue, they don't necessarily write tax provisions into this proposal that comes forward. And for example, they don't necessarily say the new top rate shall be X and it will kick in at Y. What they may well do is say, we instruct the Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee, as Bob is suggesting, to develop tax reform changes that will generate this much additional revenue over this period of time. And they might even set some parameters on it. They say the maximum rate on individual can be no higher than X, 35%, 36%. They can do all sorts of things, but I think that they're not going to make every last little detailed change here. They're going to kick it back to the committees, but they're going to have iron-bound targets that have to be met.
And that's the way to do it,
yeah.
Because you shouldn't have these members who have expertise in all kinds of areas writing tax law, which really requires a lot of expertise. And Camp is probably the only member of that committee that really has the knowledge.
Maybe we give Baucus just a
tad bit more. Well, wait a minute. Patty Murray is
she's inappropriate. She's not. But Baucus is chairman of finance.
Yeah.
And Camp is chairman of Ways and Means.
Exceed your suggestion. You're absolutely right. Max should be included.
Yeah.
I'm going to go John McLaughlin here around the table. Question is, super committee, success or failure? Al?
Oh, geez. I hope it is a success. You guys, with all of your dreaming, are beginning to make me more optimistic. So, I hope that that's what happens.
Alan,
call me Pollyanna. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bob,
I believe they will report something. I don't know what they'll report.
Does offense hurt when you write it that way, Bob?
No. Listen, my feeling is they'll get the 1.2 and probably some other things that we've been just talking about say, you know, making some recommendations to the Finance and Ways and Means Committee to do a broader scope. I think they'll get there, but, you know, it's like a 51 to 49 as far as I'm
concerned. Ralph?
I think they'll get to the 1.2, but I agree with Bob. It's not going to be pretty.
The correct answer here is it's going to be a failure. They're not going to have enough people to make a consensus to really get any of the recommendations out that will truly, although painful, truly make this situation go away in time.
Yeah.
I just don't see it happening.
Side bet.
And I hope you're wrong, but
I hope I'm wrong too.
That's the worry that that keeps me from being more optimistic.
Then we get a credit downgrade. Then.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. Is my concern is that the super committee is chartered to really come out of the box, say, look, fix this. At least come up with recommendations and hardcore targets to fix this. I don't think that the players that are involved right now, with the politics being the way they are going to be able to make the Super Committee any means of success unless they surprise me and come out with recommendations that are sustainable, targeted, and real.
The one thing that maybe you and I should include in our thinking that we haven't talked a lot about is that with Congress being as unpopular as it is, a failure to do this, I would think, would sink the boat big time. So
the economy would crash just on the downgrade.
And you're talking about political sinking.
Oh, political sinking, my gosh.
And then sink the political boats. And so you may find there more courage to do the things that Bob and Alan are talking about, and that will come out of people saying, you know, we at least have to be able to go home and say, we have accomplished this. Let's hope.
Right. Well, it's happy hour here at Backroom Politics, and now's the time in the show where we order our martinis, order our Jack Daniels, light up another cigar. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other fiscal situation that's facing everybody. By the way, the Greeks are voting on it, so basically, we're putting our hands in the face of 47 million Greeks. That's troubling. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. We'll keep
Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., America's premier cigar tavern. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio, as we are every Tuesday from 4 to 6 Eastern Time. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Alan Moore, the Honorable Bob Hines, and Dr. Ralph Winnie. I am Radio's Justin Russell, your moderator for Backroom Politics. We're going to talk about another fiscal crisis facing not only the U.S., but now global, is the situation in the European zone and the situation with the euro. The president of Greece has made the command, although weird, decision to put the austerity measures, instead of taking executive privilege, he's decided he's going to put it to a vote. And so the stability of the global economy now rests in the hands of 47 million Greeks. The reality is that the situation in Greece, last check, 297 points. The Dow is down. It'll probably close somewhere around 297, 300 points. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 have fallen suit with pretty sizable losses today.
And the European markets have gone down the same way.
Yeah, they've been taking hits. They've been taking hits since the opening on Monday. Ralph, I'll go to you. How serious is the situation in Greece right now?
I think it's very serious. I think the Greek government certainly wants to impose these austerity measures, but they recognize that the Greek people don't want it. It's sort of an unusual situation because the Greek people, you know, they're aware of the seriousness of the situation, but they don't want to compromise. They still want this cradle to grave coverage, and it's gone to the point where the G20 countries now, they're meeting, and they're putting the hammer down. If Greece does not accept this, there are going to be some severe repercussions, for the world market.
Well, we've seen just on the rumors of what's happening in Greece caused the stock market to drop almost 300 points. That's got a pretty serious ripple effect. I mean, can the global economy sustain the fate of the entire economic stability into the hands? Why wouldn't the president of Greece just take executive privilege and move forward on taking the measures himself?
Because he wants to remain as president of Greece. The people are really opposed to the bailout plan. But at the end of the day, the Greek government, I think, is going to have to do what you said and basically force this down people's throats. The interesting thing is whether China is going to come in at the last minute and bail out. Those were questions raised at several meetings I was at today, and one of their senior officials was saying, you know, look, we're only 8% of the world economy. We can't keep bailing out all these countries, but the bottom line is we don't want the Eurozone to go down because that affects everyone, the whole global community, including the Chinese economy.
Right, and just real quickly, breaking news here out of Washington. The Washington Post is now reporting on another subject. Herman Cain's accuser wants to be released from the non-disclosure agreement so she can tell her side of the story regarding the Herman Cain situation. That's just a bubble that's just going to burst real quick, kids. Just here to tell you. Bad pizza and bad NDAs. That's going to make it good. Going back to, or Alan, go ahead.
I wanted to say something about Greece. In the last 48 hours, we've got a case of one wannabe leader and one current leader who have both shown gross incompetence. Cain, as we talked about earlier, and the way he's handled this this whole business, and the president of Greece, who's got a two-vote majority.
Right.
Two-vote majority in the parliament, who thinks this is going to somehow help him. What he's probably doing, along with all of this economic trashing that's occurring around the world, he's probably put Greece on the path to being kicked out of the European Union and the Eurozone. That's the most likely path that Greece is now on. That's not good for anyone, least of all the Greek people.
Well, and I think the Greek people are saying, in effect, we'll solve this on our own. We don't need you telling us how to solve our financial crisis.
Well, let's be honest, though, Ralph. I mean, can the Greek economy sustain itself without being part of the Eurozone?
No, not in the long run. In the short run, maybe, but at the end of the day, they're just going to kill themselves.
Bob, when we look at what's happening in Greece, when we look at what's happening in Europe, ostensibly, I mean, we were talking earlier, I mean, the Greek situation has caused the failure of a major bank in Germany. You know, how many more banks have to fall before the EU starts coming to their senses saying, hey, we got a serious problem here?
Well, I don't know how many more banks have to fail, but it's very clear to me that everyone has said the same thing with respect to the Greek situation. What's amazing is, as much as difficult it is, as it is for the citizens of Greece to accept the austerity measures that are required for them to have any chance of survival, if they vote down the austerity measures, the situation is even worse, because their government is broke. They can't sell their bonds if they're not backed by support of the EU, and they wouldn't be. They can't possibly sell their bonds, which means the whole country, the pension system will fail, the health system will fail, everything will fail, and they will be absolutely destitute. I mean, it's crazy. You know, the Greeks are the guys who invented democracy. And they are just absolutely, right now, they are just destroying it. And quite frankly, it looks to me like the last time the Greeks had a functional government, Pericles was in charge. And that was 430 B.C.
Congressman Al, I'm not going to top that, but go ahead.
No, I can't.
Pericles alert.
I was going to say, when Bob invokes Pericles, we got to roll the tape on that one. Congressman Al.
I think this is a horribly pessimistic thing, but what democracy is demonstrating is that it's very, very good at giving people things. It is very, very bad at taking things away from people. And I don't think this is likely, but I think it's something we should lay on the table and keep in the back of our minds. We could be watching the beginning of the end of functioning democracy the way that we have are used to it, because we've given, in particular the Europeans and what have given and given and given, and they can't seem to take it back, and I don't know that we are going to be a lot more successful than they are.
Alan, would you agree with that?
Actually, horrible as I think all this is, it serves as an example to the super community. If we don't make these hard decisions that are in front of us, we could go the way of Greece, of Europe, of Italy, of Ireland, of Spain, of Portugal. And I hate seeing what's happening. And when the market drops 300 points in a day after having a little uptick in, because of the good things that look like they're happening in Europe, it's a really important and useful reminder to politicians that this is serious business that affects people's lives. It's time to ante up and make some hard choices.
But Alan, when we look at that, I mean, does this maybe force the hand of the U.S. government to become more isolated, centralized? Does this invoke new isolationism, not just in our country, but in other countries globally?
I don't know that we become more isolated. It's just that we're not going to step in and say, oh, let us help.
We can't even fix our own problems.
We are not going to help Europe. The role of China is an interesting one, and Ralph knows a lot more about that than anybody else. But I don't see us stepping up in a big way there. I do see us having this be one more shot that reminds us we got to take care of our own business, or only bad things.
We can't rely on other people to bail us out. The Greek people think at the end of the day there's going to be some proclamation coming out of the G20 that's going to save them. And the G20 nations are really fed up. And it's going to get to a point where the Greek president is going to have to force it down their throat.
Well, let's talk about the Chinese issue, because, you know, reports of late have made indications that the Chinese economy isn't as rock solid stable as everybody once thought. They've got their own internal
problems. They've got a lot of domestic pressures.
They've got a lot of domestic pressures. They've got their out of control spending out of Beijing.
They sell stuff to us and to Europe, and we're buying less. That hurts them.
Yeah. They need to become a more consumer-based economy.
They can't do that under the current government structure that they have out of Beijing.
They're trying with this new five-year plan, so it's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
But, Bob, is 5 years going to be enough, or are we going to see the total downfall of some major NATO countries, i.e. Greece, i.e. Spain, i.e. Portugal?
Well, number one, you certainly could, because all of those countries, I mean, if Greece goes, it's going to domino.
Yeah.
They've got, the French have a lot of bonds that are Greek bonds. The Germans have less. But the fact of the matter is, if Greece just goes blue, it implodes, the reality is that other things are going to, there are going to be other dominoes that fall. I don't know which ones are going to fall, but they're going to fall. And once it starts, it accelerates. So it's going to be a real disaster. I want to say one thing about what Alan said about this could be, this problems can be the way the market went down and what happened in Greece could be a kicker for the super committee. Think about the problem of having a vote in Greece. Now, you can't have it tomorrow. You can't do it right away. You've got to have a couple of weeks to get something like this, you know, a national plebiscite done. For the next period of time, whatever that period is, the markets all over the world are going to be
going Point. point 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 Point. point point point.